So equanimity, I wanted to start tonight with a story. And this is an experience I had about 15, 20 years ago now. My husband, Brent, and I were living in Brooklyn, New York for some crazy reason. And my husband is an artist. And one of the things that he loved to do while we were living in the city was to go to these this film center called Anthology. Anybody know about Anthology in here? Yeah, some nods. Is it still there? Yes. It's really cool. And it would show sometimes these really old vintage art films. So it's, you know, collects these films, Anthology. And one of these films that he went to was like 6 hours long. It was crazy, you know, these art films. And so he would go, and it took about, you know, 45 minutes to get there on the subway from where we lived in Brooklyn and Park Slope. And sometimes he'd get home really late. And he didn't want to wake me up, you know, so he would never call. He would never call late. And so he had gone out to one of these films and I was asleep. And so when the phone rang around midnight, I got a little worried. And what I heard on the other end was my husband moaning in agony and the voices of some police officers or subway workers saying, "Sir, sir, there's a lot of blood. Please don't try to get up." And then I heard an announcement on the loudspeaker, "We're going to have to evacuate this train." And I was, of course, screaming into the phone, "Hello, hello, hello." And no one could hear me. No one was answering. And then it went dead. Yeah. And I tried calling back and it just kept ringing and ringing, no answer. And so I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was happening. And it was midnight. And just like on that retreat, I really didn't have anyone to talk to. I didn't want to call people up and freak them out because I had no idea what was happening. And I think it was after midnight, actually. Maybe at midnight I would have ventured a call. But I really didn't know. So what happened next was kind of, in a way, fascinating to me. I went directly to my practice. And I closed my eyes, I put my hand over my heart, and I just started getting really curious about what was going on in my mind and my body, my heart. And first there was rapid heartbeat, right? Shallow breath, and just a feeling of complete panic. And I thought, okay, there's panic here. This must be panic. And with great kindness, without trying to fix it or change it, I just allowed it to be there and started investigating and getting curious about, what does panic feel like? Let me experience this in the body. And at the same time, I started noticing my thoughts and really asked myself, what am I believing here? What thoughts are creating this physical sensation, right? Because it wasn't the situation that was causing the panic in the body, right? That can't jump in there and do that. It's your thinking. And so I noticed that my mind was busy creating various scenarios, which it does. You know, my husband had been shot or stabbed or had some horrible illness that neither of us knew about, right? My mind was also running ahead into the future. You know, of course, the thoughts were like, what will I do without him? That's in there. And, you know, even crazy details, like this was for a couple of hours I had. And, you know, where would I live? You know, would I move back to Boulder? Like just crazy stuff. But I knew that I've been talking a lot today about the word allow. And I knew that if I was able to step back a bit and just allow the panic and allow the thoughts, the crazy thoughts even, and just get really curious about what was happening, that I might be able to remain balanced or even remain in relative equanimity, balance. And so I did this by first consciously bringing kindness and compassion to the panic. That's first. That's the Band-Aid or the care that you put on first. Compassion and kindness always to stop the bleeding in a way or to be with it, as well as bringing compassion and kindness to the racing thoughts. Of course I would feel this way, right? Everybody agree? Of course I would feel that way. Of course my mind would be racing. It's okay, right? And I really did feel like I was sitting with a kind friend, you know, with metta. And, you know, as you might recall, one of the root meanings of the word metta is mitra, which means friend. We have a woman here whose name is Mitra. It's so cool. I love it. And so I brought kindness. I was with myself. There was nobody else there with me. So I had to be my own friend and be there with me. And then I practiced calming the body with my breath, remembering the feelings that I was experiencing were just passing through, right? As were the thoughts. So I really allowed myself in that space to just ride the waves of that, ride the waves, letting those thoughts come and go, questioning their validity, right? Because I really had no idea what was going on. So I had to use these phrases, and I'll offer you some, and maybe I'll put these on the board because I just love phrases that I can stick in my pocket, if you will, that they're helpful. And these are from the Zen tradition. And these phrases are maybe so, maybe not. Really simple. Got to make them simple, easy to remember. Maybe so, maybe not. Not always so. Not always so. And my very favorite is, what if nothing's wrong? Which is usually the case, right? And since I didn't have any facts to go on, that really could have been the case. Everything's fine. And, you know, what I discovered is that I was doing exactly what the teachings of Vipassana meditation asked us to do, which is to rest in the not knowing, to rest in that, right? So just as with our compassionate practice, we are asked to stay. We are asked to stay. So this means we don't run around frantically in the not knowing, grasping at solutions, right? We rest in this. We become curious in order to discover the truth. The Indian philosopher Krishnamurti spoke so beautifully about this type of resting. He said, when the mind is still, tranquil, not seeking any answer or solution, neither resisting or avoiding, it is only then that there can be a regeneration, because then the mind is capable of perceiving what is true, and it is the truth that liberates, not our effort to be free. It is the truth that liberates, not our effort to be free. And so as I waited in that way for the next 2 hours, I practiced, which, by the way, means not perfectly. It's a practice, helpful to remember. And I practiced resting in the not knowing, using my practice to calm the body, you know, because I needed that calm. I needed that grounding. You know, by the time my husband called me from the hospital and told me that he had gotten food poisoning from bad chocolate milk and had fallen and hit his head, right? And his cell phone had dialed mine on speed dial, which is why I could hear all what was happening. When that happened, I was able to respond from a calm, though very tired place, and figure out how to get to him as quickly as possible, and then I was able to take care of him from a really calm place. He still has a scar on his head. He fell on the subway, but he was okay. He was fine, you know? And as I was sitting in the taxi, what I suddenly recognized, to my surprise really at that time, was that for the most part throughout that time, I had been able to stay in a relative state of equanimity or what is often called balanced awareness. Okay. And I just want to mention the interesting thing was, maybe just as encouragement, that I almost didn't do any of that purposely, right? It was like my daily practice. This is why a daily practice is so crucial and important. Retreats are fantastic, but a daily practice is so crucial. You know, for those of you who don't have one, I want to encourage you. For those who have one, keep doing it, because it just was right there. I didn't have to look for it. It turned on automatically. I did that practice, right? And so when we're used to practicing in this way daily on the cushion, it happens more and more often. It naturally kicks in. You know, it's very similar to how we learn anything, right? Like driving our cars or playing a musical instrument. When we jump in our cars, we don't have to reteach ourselves how to drive the car, right? Same kind of idea with our practice. And in the same way, through our continued daily practice, we slowly learn and discover this same thing and the same balance in our emotional lives, and we learn to trust it more. We're not so afraid of our emotions because we know how to handle them. We trust ourselves more and more and more and more to be with our emotions, to allow them, that's okay. We don't have to be afraid of them. They're just human, right? Does anybody in here blame me for panicking? Right? It's human. It's okay. As are all our emotions, but we fight with them. We struggle. We don't want them. And so over time, through our practice, we learn that we don't need to automatically react to be so attached or aversive to other people, to situations, and especially ourselves, right? Because we can be very aversive to ourselves, right? So we can learn to remain balanced, knowing that even if we fall, which we will over and over and over again, we can trust ourselves to just get back up and try again. And what we're doing here, what we're all doing together here, is learning the practice of equanimity, upekkha in Pali. And equanimity is considered the fruit of our practice. It's so important, actually, that it's often been referred to as the doorway to liberation. It's the doorway to liberation. The teacher Joseph Goldstein says that one could argue that the whole path to enlightenment rests on the maturing of this powerful, beautiful factor. Whole practice rests on the maturing of this powerful, beautiful factor. In the suttas, the Buddha describes the equanimous mind as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Okay. The Dalai Lama has called it immeasurable impartiality. Right? Immeasurable impartiality. And now if anybody is feeling intimidated by this right now, having that holy shit moment or whatever you're I want to remind you that, as Joseph Goldstein suggests, what we're doing is maturing in equanimity, which means that we can actually experience the fruit of our practice in the beginning and all throughout our practice as we continue to walk this path, right? It's not a one-time thing. So this is fantastic news, because it means we don't need to achieve enlightenment to experience a sense of equanimity, right? We can discover it all along the way, and it matures, it deepens, it gets more and more rich. You know, it's like even in the beginning, as kind of equanimity gymnasts, if you will, we aren't going to fall off that beam every single second, you know, or react negatively every time we do. As we go along, we just start discovering more and more moments of balance and ease, more and more. You string those together, and then you can really walk that beam more and more often without falling off. So, as you might expect, the practice of patience is really one of the keys to finding a more mature equanimity. And patience is actually considered one of the 10 paramis or perfections. They're called the 10 perfections. And these are 10 essential qualities of heart and mind that the Buddha asks us to consciously, kind of constantly nurture as a way to bring more joy and happiness in our lives and less suffering. So really, we all want to nurture these qualities because they're going to bring us so much more joy in our lives. How many of you know about the paramis? Just curious. Okay, some of you. If you're curious about these, I did a series of 10 talks on these, on the 10 paramis. I think there may even be a summary talk, so 11 talks, and they're up on my podcast on my website. Just if you're curious, there's other series, the Noble Eightfold Path, and different things up there. So the other 9 paramis are generosity, right? Dana, ethics, sila, renunciation, wisdom, energy, truthfulness, determination, and loving kindness, metta. So metta is also, besides being a Brahmavihara, it's also one of the 10 qualities of mind and heart. It's one of the paramis. So there's patience, really important. Another parami that's key to nurturing equanimity is renunciation, which is really letting go, because it involves letting go of our needing everything to be exactly how we want it to be. That's what we're letting go of. That's so easy, right? You know, it involves, you know, things like letting go of our need to be in control, letting go of our strongly held opinions, and letting go of our need to be right. Yeah. That righteous anger. Yeah. And letting go of all of our shoulds. That's a big one. So obviously, you know, none of this is easy, which is why, again, we practice, we practice, we practice. And again, because it's not easy, right? The parami of metta, loving kindness, is an incredibly important quality when it comes to maturing our equanimity, right? Because we want to learn how to meet the full catastrophe of our lives, all the stuff, with great, great kindness, right? With great metta. That's how we practice. If we don't have metta, we're really not even going to mature that much in our practice at all. It's going to be very surface. Must practice metta. Last year on this retreat, I loved the way Pat described equanimity as the strong back to the soft front of the heart. Isn't that nice? The strong back to the soft front of the heart. It's also been said that equanimity, which is a sense of balance and peace, is what we experience when we offer our metta, loving kindness, to both our joys and our sorrows. It's balanced. We offer metta to both. The word equanimity actually comes from the Latin phrase eco animo, which means with a calm, even mind. With a calm, even mind. And so what this means is that even if we're in physical pain or struggling in some way, the truth is more and more we begin to recognize that our contentment, our ease, comes from learning to be with what is, with a kind, patient, balanced mind. Being with what is, not battling so much with it. Just as a maybe kind of an extreme example that I heard from my friend and teacher Ruth King, such a interesting example. Say someone comes by with a car and hits a child. Okay. Is it the wisest choice to go running and screaming after the car? Right? Is it? The wisest, kindest choice is to stay with the child who's been injured, right? And then when we're with the child, how do we want to be present with them? Do we want to be present with them with anger or fear or blame? Or with great calm and compassion? No, with an even, patient, balanced mind. If you were hit by a car, wouldn't you want that person, right? And so what this might look like in our practice is whenever frustration or anger or even a deep sadness arises, instead of acting out on these emotions, which by the way is a way of running away, right? Acting out on it, running after the car is going away from the injured part of ourselves or running after something. Or letting our mind spin out with stories about the other person or people or ourselves or the situation, you know, or really believing the thoughts and identifying with them, or blaming ourselves or others or the situation, you know, with our shoulds. That's how we blame. Should is a blame, you know. We can allow, that word allow again, allow ourselves to experience that, what I like to call our internal damn it, you know, or even ouch, you know, ouch. Allow it, allow the ouch. We want to jump over that again. Allow the ouch, feel it in our bodies. And, you know, they say that you can, when something happens, it's like sudden like that, that it takes 90 seconds for an emotion to arise and pass. Like if someone cuts you off in traffic, or, you know, I think I cut someone off in yoga this this weekend accidentally, but right? This kind of an irritation. It's about a minute and a half. It's 90 seconds, which if you look at your watch and just kind of wait, you all know waiting for meditation, you know, for the bell to ring, 90 seconds sometimes can feel really long. But it's only 90 seconds. It's 90 seconds, you know. And what do we do to keep that going? Right? We just pick that ball up again. We pick it up. We blame. We try to run after. We identify with. We get into that struggle. Instead of just showering ourselves with kindness and compassion and feeling the pain. You know, that just seems so simple, and it's so hard to do in real life to stay. But once we've brought a sense of kindness and patience, you know, we can practice then we have the choice to practice things like calming our body and mind, you know, coming back into a kind of mindful balance, a conscious balance. An acceptance of what is happening right now without blame, good or bad. It's just, this is it. This is what's happening right now. An acceptance of that. There's fear. There's anger. There's whatever's happening. It's not saying you're accepting what another person is doing. Not at all. The acceptance is, this is it. This is happening. Right? Once we've done that, then we can consider, what might be the most skillful and beneficial action given our circumstances? Right? Now what? You know? So it's this idea of, all right, this isn't what I planned, you know, but this is it. Now what? This is it, is Thich Nhat Hanh's phrase. But it is always followed by now what? What is, you know, what's the best attitude, the best plan, the kindest, most compassionate response? And when we're mindful, we get, that's where we have our power, because that's where we get to choose. We don't have power over the other stuff that happens most of the time. Our power comes from our choice. How are we going to respond? Okay. And it's with equanimity, it's actually a very warm, compassionate response, a wise, mature way of responding rather than a kind of closing down or reacting, becoming angry, resentful, bitter. All those states of mind that tend to harden our hearts, which is the opposite of what we're trying to do here, especially with the Brahma Viharas. They soften the heart, as Pat was saying. They soften the heart. They warm the heart. In the Buddha said that a mature equanimity produces a radiance and a warmth of being. And there's a Tibetan word for this warmth, which is called siwa. It's spelled T-S-E-W-A. The T is silent, right? Siwa, when someone has siwa, a warmth of kindness, a radiance of being. And I know we've all met people like this, right? That someone who has calm and balance during both moments of great joy and sorrow. They're not elated, like Pat said. They're not falling down the ground giggling, right? They're calmly joyful. They're calmly compassionate, right? They're not cold, though, are they? It feels good to be in their presence. It's not a coldness. And yet there seems to be this really popular myth around Buddhist practice, and in this country especially, where when Buddhists talk about equanimity, they're talking about something very serious, or, you know, kind of dry neutrality, or maybe a cool aloofness, right? Sometimes people think of it as even a kind of resignation or a kind of indifference. And those two definitions are actually really almost kind of toxic. So, and harmful in a way. So, you know, any of you who may have lived with a teenager might know what I'm talking about. Well, whatever. Whatever. Or it doesn't matter, or I don't care, right? At its most painful, it might involve an attitude of, I don't matter, right? Or, well, these things always happen to me, it's just one more thing. Or even, I just need to grit my teeth and smile through this. That is not equanimity. All of those things harden the heart, don't they? You know, when you're holding on, I just got to get through this. That's not equanimity. This type of relating is actually considered the near enemy of equanimity because it can sometimes disguise itself as equanimity. You know, can appear to be equanimity. But both resignation and indifference involve a kind of coldness. You know, they involve a sense of being disconnected from whatever's happening, don't they? When you're, you know, indifferent or you have resignation, there's no, you're not connected, cold. So when we're indifferent or we're resigned, we've actually become separated from our hearts rather than with our hearts or with one another. No, we've become cold, not warm, when we're not connecting with ourselves or others. We can become cold to ourselves, right? Disconnecting from ourselves. So with equanimity practice, we are warming up, we are softening, and allowing ourselves to feel. Let our hearts be open to whatever we're feeling with great kindness and tons of metta. We bathe in it. Because the truth is, if we harden our hearts against all the pain that we're going to feel, guess what? We harden our hearts against all the joy that we're going to feel as well. It goes both ways. Okay? So maybe that's kind of an encouragement to allow yourself to feel the pain. If you want to feel the joy, that's your payment. You know? In his famous essay, Notes of a Native Son, the writer James Baldwin points to this. It began to seem that one would have to hold in the mind forever two ideas which seemed to be in opposition. The first idea was acceptance, the acceptance totally without rancor of life as it is and men as they are. In the light of this idea, it goes without saying that injustice is a commonplace. But this did not mean that one could be complacent, for the second idea was of equal power, that one must never in one's own life accept the injustices as commonplace, but must fight them with all one's strength. This fight begins, however, in the heart, and it now had been laid to my charge to keep my own heart free of hatred and despair. Okay. So the beauty of equanimity really begins to happen when that wave of fear, anger, or sadness comes. You know, we allow ourselves, if you will, to take that hit, to feel it fully, to let the wave flow through us, right? And when we can allow it, the cool part is that we can bounce back much quicker because we have let it pass. We haven't struggled to resist it so much. It passes when we soften instead of harden. It passes so much quicker and we'll feel it more fully, right? Do any of you remember, I think many of you are from Virginia, some aren't, but from those of you who are from Virginia, does anybody remember that weird earthquake we had like 3 or 4 years ago? Yeah, it was so bizarre. And I was actually lying down on what's called a Shakti mat. Anybody know what these are? Oh, they're fantastic. Okay, secret. Oh, they're so good. They're like a little bed of nails, but they're plastic. Yeah. When the earthquake kicked, that's what I was on. But they kind of hurt a little bit when they're not crazy. You know, they're not crazy painful, but when you lie down on them, they're a little painful. It's like acupressure kind of. And the back and the body gets really, really warm. My husband falls asleep on it all the time. It's called a Shakti mat, if anybody wants to try it out. But so I felt it, you know, I was on my Shakti mat. Whoa. And a friend of mine and his wife, they're in their 80s. They're these old hippies. I love them so much. They have this, they're hermits, really. They have this property out in the woods. They built a cootie hut, which many of you may know is a meditation kind of hut. But they built their house under the earth, underground. They're like hobbits, right? So you can mow the top of their house, right? They're hippies, I know. So when that earthquake happened, we were talking about it. They just felt like a tiny blip. They barely felt it, right? And why do you think that was? It's because there weren't any walls. There was no resistance. There was no resistance. It was the earth. And so it just passed really quickly, right? And they came into balance so much quicker than everybody else because there was no resistance. And as we all know, resistance makes everything so much more difficult, makes the suffering that we're experiencing so much, it lasts so much longer. We think that like resisting it's going to work. And I'm here to tell you that that just makes it worse, right? So helpful to remember. You know, and it's of course not that there's no suffering in life. That's the first noble truth. There is suffering. There is suffering. Thankfully, the Buddha did not say all of life is suffering. You know, just said there is suffering. That's the truth. First noble truth. There's suffering and we're all going to experience it. It's just that resisting what is unpleasant only adds stress to what is already a difficult situation, right? It's that very old equation of pain times resistance equals the amount of stress and suffering that we're going to experience. And so with equanimity practice, what we're learning is that we really need to let things flow through like a wave, feel them fully, right? Feel the joy wave fully. Woo, there it is. I'm feeling the joy. I know it's going to go. I'm not going to cling to it. But man, I'm going to ride that wave of joy. But here comes that shame wave. Oh, shit. I don't want that. Right? And we become a block of ice. But that only locks it in, doesn't it? Then we become ice. That's really not helpful. So Bhikkhu Anayo, who is the modern day scholar of the Satipatthana Sutra, which is the four foundations of mindfulness, which is basically essentially the instructions for how we practice. I studied with him a year ago, and he's fantastic. And he has summed up the entire practice of meditation in four words. And I use these four words so much that a student of mine made me bumper stickers. So they're on my car. Some of you may have seen this already. But the four words that sum up our entire practice. You ready? Keep calmly knowing change. Keep, right, consistently, calmly knowing, being aware of change. That's it. You can all go home now. That's it. So in the Pali language, there's actually several words for equanimity, and the most common is upekkha, and its root meaning is to look over. So it refers to equanimity that arises from the power of observation, the ability to see without being caught up in what we're seeing, okay? To look over. And this is where our daily practice on our cushion comes into play, because it allows us to become aware of what's happening, you know, what we're experiencing, thoughts and emotions that are arising, without necessarily believing them as true or acting upon them, right? Again, we can simply rest in the awareness of whatever's happening. And that resting place, that awareness, is actually calm. The resting place is calm. So on another recent retreat that I was on with the teacher Kamala Masters, who's wonderful, she gave us a good tip for this, how to practice this. And I want to share that with you. She said, when you find yourself suddenly caught up in old habitual beliefs and stories, anybody have that happen this weekend? Just a couple people. She says, when that happens, it can be helpful to simply tell those beliefs, not now, not now. I do that all the time, not now. Just set them down, not now. In India, the word upekkha was also sometimes used to mean to see with patience, to see with patience. And the theologian Howard Thurman has said that we need to practice looking at the world with quiet eyes. To look at the world with quiet eyes. Just love that. And I love this metaphor of like, you know, this practice is almost like a form of grandmotherly love, where the grandmother clearly loves her grandchildren, but thanks to her experience with her own children, right? This is that maturity part, you know. She's going to be less likely to be caught up in reaction or drama when her grandchild maybe screams something at her like, I hate you, right? There's that calm equanimity. Like, I see that. I'm not going to get caught up in that. I know what that looks like, you know. So in the same way, very same way, we can begin to recognize when we ourselves are saying, I hate you, to ourselves, right? When we're doing that, which we do sometimes often, right? and to see that it isn't true or necessary or very helpful to be able to deal with what's happening. You know, several years ago, on a longer retreat I was on, it was about the third or fourth day, which is usually when that stuff comes up, I started seeing these old habitual patterns of thinking that I get sometimes, which is that even after 30 years of practice, I'm not doing it right. I'm not. Anybody have that this weekend? Just curious. Yeah. I'm not doing it right. Right. So I should have been meditating instead of taking that nap, or I was making too much noise when I was getting up at night to use the restroom. And all of these subtle ways of kind of saying, I hate you to myself in some way. Right. You're not doing it right. Blaming, shoulding all over myself. Right. So maybe not that extreme, I hate you, but it was definitely relating to myself with aversion. And, of course, I was also starting to notice when other people weren't doing things the way I thought that they should be doing them, right? So they weren't being mindful to hold that door closed, you know, when it slammed shut, or they were showing up too late to the sits, or snoring during some of the sits, right? Or all of the stuff that people just do. So my mind came up with a fun solution that I recognized was a kind of acceptance, a way of not making myself or the situation or anyone else wrong, okay? And I considered it a kind of equanimity practice as well as a practice in metta. It was a metta practice. So I want to offer this to you because it helped me so much on that particular retreat. And the phrase was really simple. It was simply, not an asshole. Not an asshole. I really used it the whole time. It was a metta phrase. You won't find that in the suttas. But it helps. So, you know, this meant, you know, I really did practice it. It was like, it meant me when I did something I thought was wrong. I'm not an asshole, you know. Anytime anything, you know, somebody else did something, not an asshole. And, you know, so if you can use that, I hope that's helpful. What is in the scriptures, though, is the training of really noticing, being aware of whenever we're experiencing some kind of suffering and becoming mindful about how we might be wanting things to be different than they actually are. Okay? So you might then notice and investigate the suffering that occurs from not wanting it to be a certain way, or wanting it to be a certain way. So we can just make a practice of just noticing all the wanting and not wanting. That can be an incredibly transformative practice, to just start to notice when you're wanting something to be a certain way and when you're not wanting something to be a certain way. Okay? And when you start to do this, you might start to notice, for instance, that grasping on to clinging to what is pleasant tends to set us up for the suffering of impermanence, anicca, because again, change is inevitable. It's inevitable. You know, we'd often think of grasping at what is pleasant as suffering, but start to notice how much it is, right? Want that to stay. I want my youth to stay. I want my this to stay. I want it to be this way always. Another word often translated as equanimity is tatra mahatata, which means ultimately to stand in the middle of all of this, to stand in the middle of all of it. And as you know, the Buddha termed the entire practice as the middle way. So when we're walking on the path of the middle way, what we begin to realize is that happiness is at the very center, it's at the center of wanting and not wanting. It's in the center. Happiness happens when we are not clinging to anything that is impermanent, including ourselves, right? We are simply learning to observe when things create happiness in the mind arise and when things that create unhappiness arise in the mind. And we do this by recognizing and remembering nothing is really happy or unhappy in and of itself, right? No thing, no person, no situation. But in how we are thinking about these things or relating to them, remember that even these things are ephemeral, not real. It's really only what we make of them. Always, well, only what we make of them. Just as an example, rain, right? Sometimes it just feels really comforting and soothing, right? And other times it just feels dreary and depressing. It's still just rain, right? It's what we're making of it. What conditions are in the mind, heart, and body at that moment to perceive that? Staying in the middle also points to this idea that when things naturally arise and pass, we learn to kindly and patiently stay in the middle instead of running left or right, trying to somehow escape the reality of the particular situation, right? And we do this in many ways by running towards what we think is going to help us to find happiness and relief. We run towards it, right? Trying really hard to fix something. It's another strategy, right? We try to fix it. We try to fix ourselves or the situation or someone else. Anybody ever try to do that? Right? Fix someone else. Never works, but we keep trying. Another strategy is that we beat ourselves up about it, or we fall into despair, you know? Or we indulge in habits or behaviors that are ultimately covering over something and are bad for us ultimately. And so just like we kindly train a puppy, as we mature and follow the middle way, eventually, with kindness and patience, training that puppy, if you will, we eventually learn to stay. Eventually, we learn to stay. To quote my favorite Buddhist nun again, Pema Chodron, she tells us, as human beings, not only do we seek resolution, but we feel that we deserve resolution. However, not only do we not deserve resolution, we suffer from resolution. We don't deserve resolution. We deserve something better than that. We deserve our birthright, which is the middle way, an open state of mind that can relax with paradox and ambiguity. So I think I want to end there and just invite us all into a brief, very brief sitting to end. And so just taking, again, a nice deep breath in and out. And see if you can have a sense of even maybe the body is sore or tired. Whatever's happening, can there be a sense of stay? What would it feel like to just kindly and patiently stay with whatever's in the heart, body, mind, not running away, covering over, running, escaping, fixing, beating ourselves up, just being here with the heart. Might even sometimes hear in the mind the word stay. Or please don't abandon me. Stay. Maybe setting that intention in the mind for yourself. What would stay look like for you? What would it mean to stay? What do you need to stay with? Finally, with the eyes closed, just listening to these words from William Stafford, who tells us, I like to live in the sound of water, in the feel of the mountain air. A sharp reminder hits me, this world is still alive. It stretches out there, shivering towards its own creation, and I am a part of it. Even my breathing enters into this elaborate give and take, this bowing to sun and moon, day and night, winter, summer, storm, still. This tranquil chaos that seems to be going somewhere. This wilderness with a great peacefulness in it. This motionless turmoil. This everything dance.